Night, Cassette 2.
One Sunday, when half of us, including my father, were at work, the rest, including myself, were in the block, taking advantage of the chance to stay in bed late in the morning. At about 10 o'clock, the air raid sirens began to wail, an alert. The leaders of the block ran to assemble us inside, while the SS took refuge in the shelters. As it was relatively easy to escape during a warning, the guards left their lookout posts and the electric current was cut off in the barbed wire fences, the SS had orders to kill anyone found outside the blocks. Within a few minutes, the camp looked like an abandoned ship, not a living soul on the paths. Near the kitchen, two cauldrons of steaming hot soup had been left, half full. Two cauldrons of soup, right in the middle of the path, with no one guarding them. A feast for kings, abandoned, supreme temptation. Hundreds of eyes looked at them, sparkling with desire. Two lambs with 100 wolves lying in wait for them. Two lambs without a shepherd, a gift. But who would dare? Terror was stronger than hunger. Suddenly, we saw the door of Block 37 open imperceptibly. A man appeared, crawling like a worm in the direction of the cauldrons. Hundreds of eyes followed his movements. Hundreds of men crawled with him, scraping their knees with his on the gravel. Every heart trembled, but with envy above all, this man had dared. He reached the first cauldron. Hearts raced. He had succeeded. Jealousy consumed us, burned us up like straw. We never thought for a moment of admiring him. Poor hero, committing suicide for a ration of soup. In our thoughts, we were murdering him. Stretched out by the cauldron, he was now trying to raise himself up to the edge. Either from weakness or fear, he stayed there, trying, no doubt, to muster up the last of his strength. At last he succeeded in hoisting himself onto the edge of the pot. For a moment he seemed to be looking at himself, seeking his ghost-like reflection in the soup. Then, for no apparent reason, he let out a terrible cry, a rattle such as I had never heard before, and, his mouth open, thrust his head toward the still steaming liquid. We jumped at the explosion, falling back onto the ground, his face stained with soup. The man writhed for a few seconds at the foot of the cauldron. Then he moved no more. Then we began to hear the airplanes. Almost at once the barracks began to shake. "They're bombing Buna," someone shouted. I thought of my father. But I was glad all the same to see the whole works go up in fire. What revenge! We had heard so much talk about the defeats of German troops on various fronts, but we did not know how much to believe. This, today, was real. We were not afraid, and yet, if a bomb had fallen on the blocks, it alone would have claimed hundreds of victims on the spot. But we were no longer afraid of death. At any rate, not of that death. Every bomb that exploded filled us with joy and gave us new confidence in life. The raid lasted over an hour. If it could only have lasted 10 times 10 hours. Then silence fell once more. The last sound of an American plane was lost on the wind, and we found ourselves back again in the cemetery. A great trail of black smoke was rising up on the horizon. The sirens began to wail once more. It was the end of the alert. Everyone came out of the blocks. We filled our lungs with the fire and smoke-laden air, and our eyes shone with hope. A bomb had fallen in the middle of the camp near the assembly point, but it had not gone off. We had to take it outside the camp. The head of the camp, accompanied by his assistant and the chief capo, made a tour of inspection along the paths. The raid had left traces of terror on his face. Right in the middle of the camp lay the body of the man with the soup-stained face, the only victim. The cauldrons were taken back into the kitchen. The SS had gone back to their lookout posts behind their machine guns. The interlude was over. At the end of an hour, we saw the units come back in step as usual. Joyfully, I caught sight of my father. "Several buildings have been flattened right out," he said, "but the warehouse hasn't suffered." In the afternoon, we went cheerfully to clear away the ruins. A week later, on the way back from work, we noticed in the center of the camp, at the assembly place, a black gallows. We were told that soup would not be distributed until after roll call. This took longer than usual. The orders were given in a sharper manner than on other days, and in the air there were strange undertones. "Bare your heads," yelled the head of the camp suddenly. 10,000 caps were simultaneously removed. "Cover your heads." 10,000 caps went back onto their skulls as quick as lightning. The gate to the camp opened. An SS section appeared and surrounded us, one SS at every 3 paces. On the lookout towers, the machine guns were trained on the assembly place. "They fear trouble," whispered Yuryek. 2 SS men had gone to the cells. They came back with the condemned man between them. He was a youth from Warsaw. He had 3 years of concentration camp life behind him. He was a strong, well-built boy, a giant in comparison with me. His back to the gallows, his face turned toward his judge, who was the head of the camp, the boy was pale, but seemed more moved than afraid. His manacled hands did not tremble. His eyes gazed coldly at the hundreds of SS guards, the thousands of prisoners who surrounded him. The head of the camp began to read his verdict, hammering out each phrase. "In the name of Himmler, prisoner number, stole during the alert, according to the law, paragraph, prisoner number, is condemned to death. May this be a warning and an example to all prisoners." No one moved. I could hear my heart beating. The thousands who had died daily at Auschwitz and at Birkenau in the crematory ovens no longer troubled me, but this one, leaning against his gallows, he overwhelmed me. "Do you think this ceremony will be over soon? I'm hungry," whispered Yuryek. At a sign from the head of the camp, the Lagerkapo advanced toward the condemned man. 2 prisoners helped him in his task for 2 plates of soup. The Kapo wanted to bandage the victim's eyes, but he refused. After a long moment of waiting, the executioner put the rope round his neck. He was on the point of motioning to his assistants to draw the chair away from the prisoner's feet when the latter cried in a calm, strong voice, "Long live liberty! A curse upon Germany! A curse! A cur—" The executioners had completed their task. A command cleft the air like a sword. "Bare your heads!" 10,000 prisoners paid their last respects. "Cover your heads!" Then the whole camp, block after block, had to march past the hanged man and stare at the dimmed eyes, the lolling tongue of death. The capos and heads of each block forced everyone to look him full in the face. After the march, we were given permission to return to the blocks for our meal. I remember that I found the soup excellent that evening. I witnessed other hangings. I never saw a single one of the victims weep. For a long time, those dried-up bodies had forgotten the bitter taste of tears. Except once. The Oberkapo of the 52nd Cable Unit was a Dutchman, a giant, well over 6 feet. 700 prisoners worked under his orders, and they all loved him like a brother. No one had ever received a blow at his hands, nor an insult from his lips. He had a young boy under him, a Pippel, as they were called, a child with a refined and beautiful face, unheard of in this camp. At Buna, the Pippel were loathed. They were often crueler than adults. I once saw one of 13 beating his father because the latter had not made his bed properly. The old man was crying softly while the boy shouted, "If you don't stop crying at once, I shan't bring you any more bread. Do you understand?" But the Dutchman's little servant was loved by all. He had the face of a sad angel. One day, the electric power station at Buna was blown up. The Gestapo, summoned to the spot, suspected sabotage. They found a trail. It eventually led to the Dutch Oberkapo. And there, after a search, they found an important stock of arms. The Oberkapo was arrested immediately. He was tortured for a period of weeks, but in vain. He would not give a single name. He was transferred to Auschwitz. We never heard of him again. But his little servant had been left behind in the camp, in prison. Also put to torture, he too would not speak. Then the SS sentenced him to death with two other prisoners who had been discovered with arms. One day when we came back from work, we saw three gallows rearing up in the assembly place, three black crows. Roll call, SS all round us, machine guns trained, the traditional ceremony. Three victims in chains, and one of them, the little servant, the sad-eyed angel. The SS seemed more preoccupied, more disturbed than usual. To hang a young boy in front of thousands of spectators was no light matter. The head of the camp read the verdict. All eyes were on the child. He was lividly pale, almost calm, biting his lips. The gallows threw its shadow over him. This time, the Lager Kapo refused to act as executioner. Three SS replaced him. The three victims mounted together onto the chairs. The three necks were placed at the same moment within the nooses. "Long live liberty!" cried the two adults. But the child was silent. "Where is God? Where is he?" someone behind me asked. At a sign from the head of the camp, the three chairs tipped over. Total silence throughout the camp. On the horizon, the sun was setting. "Bare your heads," yelled the head of the camp. His voice was raucous. We were weeping. "Cover your heads." Then the march past began. The two adults were no longer alive. Their tongues hung, swollen, blue-tinged. But the third rope was still moving. Being so light, the child was still alive. For more than half an hour, he stayed there, struggling between life and death, dying in slow agony under our eyes. And we had to look him full in the face. He was still alive when I passed in front of him. His tongue was still red. His eyes were not yet glazed. Behind me, I heard the same man asking, "Where is God now?" And I heard a voice within me answer him, "Where is he? Here he is. He is hanging here on this gallows." That night, the soup tasted of corpses. The summer was coming to an end. The Jewish year was nearly over. On the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the last day of that accursed year, the whole camp was electric with the tension which was in all our hearts. In spite of everything, this day was different from any other. The last day of the year, the word "last" rang very strangely. What if it were indeed the last day? They gave us our evening meal, a very thick soup, but no one touched it. We wanted to wait until after prayers. At the place of assembly, surrounded by the electrified barbed wire, thousands of silent Jews gathered, their faces stricken. Night was falling. Other prisoners continued to crowd in from every block, able suddenly to conquer time and space and submit both to their will. "What are you, my God?" I thought angrily, "compared to this afflicted crowd proclaiming to you their faith, their anger, their revolt? What does your greatness mean, Lord of the universe, in the face of all this weakness, this decomposition and this decay? Why do you still trouble their sick minds?
their crippled bodies.
10,000 men had come to attend the solemn service. Heads of the blocks, capos, functionaries of death. Bless the Eternal. The voice of the officiant had just made itself heard. I thought at first it was the wind. Blessed be the name of the Eternal. Thousands of voices repeated the benediction. Thousands of men prostrated themselves like trees before a tempest. Blessed be the name of the Eternal. Why? But why should I bless him? In every fiber I rebelled. Because he had had thousands of children burned in his pits? Because he kept 6 crematories working day and night on Sundays and feast days? Because in his great might he had created Auschwitz, Birkenau, Buna, and so many factories of death? How could I say to him, Blessed art thou, Eternal, Master of the universe, who chose us from among the races to be tortured day and night, to see our fathers, our mothers, our brothers end in the crematory? Praised be thy holy name, thou who hast chosen us to be butchered on thine altar? I heard the voice of the officiant rising up, powerful yet at the same time broken amid the tears, sobs, the sighs of the whole congregation. All the earth and the universe are God's. He kept stopping every moment as though he did not have the strength to find the meaning beneath the words. The melody choked in his throat. And I, mystic that I had been, I thought, yes, man is very strong, greater than God. When you were deceived by Adam and Eve, you drove them out of paradise. When Noah's generation displeased you, you brought down the flood. When Sodom no longer found favor in your eyes, you made the sky rain down fire and sulfur. But these men here, whom you have betrayed, whom you have allowed to be tortured, butchered, gassed, burned, what do? They pray before you. They praise your name. All creation bears witness to the greatness of God. Once New Year's Day had dominated my life. I knew that my sins grieved the Eternal. I implored his forgiveness. Once I had believed profoundly that upon one solitary deed of mine, one solitary prayer, depended the salvation of the world. This day I had ceased to plead. I was no longer capable of lamentation. On the contrary, I felt very strong. I was the accuser, God the accused. My eyes were open and I was alone, terribly alone in a world without God and without man, without love or mercy. I had ceased to be anything but ashes. Yet I felt myself to be stronger than the Almighty, to whom my life had been tied for so long. I stood amid that praying congregation, observing it like a stranger. The service ended with the Kaddish. Everyone recited the Kaddish over his parents, over his children, over his brothers, and over himself. We stayed for a long time at the assembly place. No one dared to drag himself away from this mirage. Then it was time to go to bed, and slowly the prisoners made their way over to their blocks. I heard people wishing one another a happy new year. I ran off to look for my father, and at the same time I was afraid of having to wish him a happy new year when I no longer believed in it. He was standing near the wall, bowed down, his shoulders sagging as though beneath a heavy burden. I went up to him, took his hand, and kissed it. A tear fell upon it. Whose was that tear? Mine? His? I said nothing, nor did he. We had never understood one another so clearly. The sound of the bell jolted us back to reality. We must go to bed. We came back from far away. I raised my eyes to look at my father's face leaning over mine, to try to discover a smile or something resembling one upon the aged, dried-up countenance. Nothing. Not the shadow of an expression. Beaten. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Should we fast? The question was hotly debated. To fast would mean a surer, swifter death. We fasted here the whole year round. The whole year was Yom Kippur. But others said that we should fast simply because it was dangerous to do so. We should show God that even here, in this enclosed hell, we were capable of singing his praises. I did not fast, mainly to please my father, who had forbidden me to do so. But further, there was no longer any reason why I should fast. I no longer accepted God's silence. As I swallowed my bowl of soup, I saw in the gesture an act of rebellion and protest against him. And I nibbled my crust of bread. In the depths of my heart, I felt a great void. The SS gave us a fine New Year's gift. We had just come back from work. As soon as we had passed through the door of the camp, we sensed something different in the air. Roll call did not take so long as usual. The evening soup was given out with great speed and swallowed down at once in anguish. I was no longer in the same block as my father. I had been transferred to another unit, the building one, where 12 hours a day I had to drag heavy blocks of stone about. The head of my new block was a German Jew, small of stature, with piercing eyes. He told us that evening that no one would be allowed to go out after the evening soup. And soon a terrible word was circulating. Selection. We knew what that meant. An SS man would examine us. Whenever he found a weak one, a Musulman, as we called them, he would write his number down. Good for the crematory. After soup, we gathered together between the beds. The veteran said, "You're lucky to have been brought here so late. This camp is paradise today compared with what it was like 2 years ago. Buna was a real hell then. There was no water, no blankets, less soup and bread. At night we slept almost naked, and it was below 30 degrees. The corpses were collected in hundreds every day. The work was hard. Today this is a little paradise. The capos had orders to kill a certain number of prisoners every day, and every week, selection. A merciless selection. Yes, you're lucky." "Stop it. Be quiet," I begged. "You can tell your stories tomorrow or on some other day." They burst out laughing. They were not veterans for nothing. "Are you scared? So were we scared. And there was plenty to be scared of in those days." The old men stayed in their corner, dumb, motionless, haunted. Some were praying. An hour's delay. In an hour we should know the verdict, death or a reprieve. And my father? Suddenly I remembered him. How would he pass the selection? He had aged so much. The head of our block had never been outside concentration camps since 1933. He had already been through all the slaughterhouses, all the factories of death. At about 9 o'clock he took up his position in our midst. "Achtung!" There was instant silence. "Listen carefully to what I'm going to say." For the first time I heard his voice quiver. "In a few moments, the selection will begin. You must get completely undressed. Then one by one you go before the SS doctors. I hope you will all succeed in getting through, but you must help your own chances. Before you go into the next room, move about in some way so that you give yourselves a little color. Don't walk slowly. Run. Run as if the devil were after you. Don't look at the SS. Run straight in front of you." He broke off for a moment, then added, "And the essential thing, don't be afraid." Here was a piece of advice we should have liked very much to be able to follow. I got undressed, leaving my clothes on the bed. There was no danger of anyone stealing them this evening. Tibby and Yossi, who had changed their unit at the same time as I had, came up to me and said, "Let's keep together, we shall be stronger." Yossi was murmuring something between his teeth. He must have been praying. I had never realized that Yossi was a believer. I had even always thought the reverse. Tibby was silent, very pale. All the prisoners in the block stood naked between the beds. This must be how one stands at the last judgment. "They're coming!" There were three SS officers standing round the notorious Dr. Mengele, who had received us at Birkenau. The head of the block, with an attempt at a smile, asked us, "Ready?" Yes, we were ready. So were the SS doctors. Dr. Mengele was holding a list in his hand, our numbers. He made a sign to the head of the block, "We can begin," as if this were a game. The first to go by were the officials of the block, Stubenälteste, capos, foremen, all in perfect physical condition, of course. Then came the ordinary prisoner's turn. Dr. Mengele took stock of them from head to foot. Every now and then he wrote a number down. One single thought filled my mind, not to let my number be taken, not to show my left arm. There were only Tibby and Yossi in front of me. They passed. I had time to notice that Mengele had not written their numbers down. Someone pushed me. It was my turn. I ran without looking back. My head was spinning. "You're too thin. You're weak. You're too thin. You're good for the furnace." The race seemed interminable. I thought I had been running for years. "You're too thin. You're too weak." At last I had arrived, exhausted. When I regained my breath, I questioned Yossi and Tibby. "Was I written down?" "No," said Yossi. He added, smiling, "In any case, he couldn't have written you down. You were running too fast." I began to laugh. I was glad. I would have liked to kiss him. At that moment, what did the others matter? I hadn't been written down. Those whose numbers had been noted stood apart, abandoned by the whole world. Some were weeping in silence. The SS officers went away. The head of the block appeared, his face reflecting the general weariness. "Everything went off all right, don't worry. Nothing is going to happen to anyone, to anyone." Again he tried to smile. A poor, emaciated, dried-up Jew questioned him avidly in a trembling voice. But, Block Älteste, they did write me down." The head of the block let his anger break out. "What? Did someone refuse to believe him? What's the matter now? Am I telling lies, then? I tell you once and for all, nothing's going to happen to you, to anyone. You're wallowing in your own despair, you fool." The bell rang, a signal that the selection had been completed throughout the camp. With all my might, I began to run to Block 36. I met my father on the way. He came up to me. "Well, so you passed?" "Yes, and you?" "Me too." How we breathed again now. My father had brought me a present, half a ration of bread obtained in exchange for a piece of rubber found at the warehouse, which would do to sole a shoe. The bell. Already we must separate, go to bed. Everything was regulated by the bell. It gave me orders, and I automatically obeyed them. I hated it. Whenever I dreamed of a better world, I could only imagine a universe with no bells. Several days had elapsed. We no longer thought about the selection. We went to work as usual, loading heavy stones into railway wagons. Rations had become more meager. This was the only change. We had risen before dawn, as on every day. We had received the black coffee, the ration of bread. We were about to set out for the yard as usual. The head of the block arrived, running. "Silence for a moment. I have a list of numbers here. I'm going to read them to you. Those whose numbers I call won't be going to work this morning. They'll stay behind in the camp." And in a soft voice, he read out about 10 numbers. We had understood. These were numbers chosen at the selection. Dr. Mengele had not forgotten. The head of the block went toward his room. 10 prisoners surrounded him, hanging onto his clothes. "Save us, you promised. We want to go to the yard. We're strong enough to work. We're good workers. We can. We will." He tried to calm them, to reassure them about their fate, to explain to them that the fact that they were staying behind in the camp did not mean much, had no tragic significance. "After all, I stay here myself every day," he added. It was a somewhat feeble argument. He realized it, and, without another word, went and shut himself up in his room. The bell had just rung. "Form up!" It scarcely mattered now that the work was hard. The essential thing was to be as far away as possible from the block, from the crucible of death, from the center of hell. I saw my father running toward me. I became frightened all of a sudden. "What's the matter?" Out of breath, he could hardly open his mouth. "Me too. Me too. They told me to stay behind in the camp." They had written down his number without his being aware of it. "What will happen?" I asked in anguish. But it was he who tried to reassure me. "It isn't certain yet. There's still a chance of escape. They're going to do another selection today, a decisive selection." I was silent. He felt that his time was short. He spoke quickly. He would have liked to say so many things. His speech grew confused, his voice choked. He knew that I would have to go in a few moments. He would have to stay behind alone, so very alone. "Look, take this knife," he said to me. "I don't need it any longer. It might be useful to you. And take this spoon as well. Don't sell them. Quickly, go on. Take what I'm giving you." The inheritance. "Don't talk like that, Father." I felt that I would break into sobs. "I don't want you to say that. Keep the spoon and knife. You need them as much as I do. We shall see each other again this evening after work." He looked at me with his tired eyes, veiled with despair. He went on, "I'm asking this of you. Take them. Do as I ask, my son. We have no time. Do as your father asks." Our capo yelled that we should start. The unit set out toward the camp gate, left, right. I bit my lips. My father had stayed by the block, leaning against the wall. Then he began to run to catch up with us. Perhaps he had forgotten something he wanted to say to me, but we were marching too quickly, left, right. We were already at the gate. They counted us to the din of military music. We were outside. The whole day, I wandered about as if sleepwalking. Now and then, Tibby and Yossi would throw me a brotherly word. The capo, too, tried to reassure me. He had given me easier work today. I felt sick at heart. How well they were treating me. Like an orphan. I thought, even now, my father is still helping me. I did not know myself what I wanted. For the day to pass quickly or not. I was afraid of finding myself alone that night. How good it would be to die here. At last we began the return journey. How I longed for orders to run. The military march, the gate, the camp, I ran to Block 36. Were there still miracles on this earth? He was alive. He had escaped the second selection. He had been able to prove that he was still useful. I gave him back his knife and spoon. Akiba Drummer left us, a victim of the selection. Lately he had wandered among us, his eyes glazed, telling everyone of his weakness. "I can't go on. It's all over." It was impossible to raise his morale. He didn't listen to what we told him. He could only repeat that all was over for him, that he could no longer keep up the struggle, that he had no strength left, nor faith. Suddenly his eyes would become blank, nothing but two open wounds, two pits of terror. He was not the only one to lose his faith during those selection days. I knew a rabbi from a little town in Poland, a bent old man whose lips were always trembling. He used to pray all the time, in the block, in the yard, in the ranks. He would recite whole pages of the Talmud from memory, argue with himself, ask himself questions, and answer himself. And one day he said to me, "It's the end. God is no longer with us." And as though he had repented of having spoken such words, so clipped, so cold, he added in his faint voice, "I know. One has no right to say things like that. I know. Man is too small. too humble and inconsiderable to seek to understand the mysterious ways of God. But what can I do? I'm not a sage, one of the elect, nor a saint. I'm just an ordinary creature of flesh and blood. I've got eyes, too, and I can see what they're doing here. Where is the divine mercy? Where is God? How can I believe? How could anyone believe in this merciful God? Poor Akiba Drummer. If he could have gone on believing in God, if he could have seen a proof of God in this Calvary, he would not have been taken by this election. But as soon as he felt the first cracks forming in his faith, he had lost his reason for struggling and had begun to die. When the selection came, he was condemned in advance, offering his own neck to the executioner. All he asked of us was, "In 3 days I shall no longer be here. Say the Kaddish for me." We promised him. In 3 days' time, when we saw the smoke rising from the chimney, we would think of him. 10 of us would gather together and hold a special service. All his friends would say the Kaddish. Then he went off toward the hospital, his step steadier, not looking back. An ambulance was waiting to take him to Birkenau. These were terrible days. We received more blows than food. We were crushed with work. And 3 days after he had gone, we forgot to say the Kaddish. Winter had come. The days were short, and the nights had become almost unbearable. In the first hours of dawn, the icy wind cut us like a whip. We were given winter clothes, slightly thicker striped shirts. The veterans found in this a new source of derision. "Now you'll really be getting a taste of the camp." We left for work as usual, our bodies frozen. The stones were so cold that it seemed as though our hands would be glued to them if we touched them. But you get used to anything. On Christmas and New Year's Day, there was no work. We were allowed a slightly thicker soup. Toward the middle of January, my right foot began to swell because of the cold. I was unable to put it on the ground. I went to have it examined. The doctor, a great Jewish doctor, a prisoner like ourselves, was quite definite. I must have an operation. If we waited, the toes, and perhaps the whole leg, would have to be amputated. This was the last straw, but I had no choice. The doctor had decided on an operation, and there was no discussing it. I was even glad that it was he who had made the decision. They put me into a bed with white sheets. I had forgotten that people slept in sheets. The hospital was not bad at all. We were given good bread and thicker soup. No more bell, no more roll call, no more work. Now and then I was able to send a bit of bread to my father. Near me lay a Hungarian Jew who had been struck down with dysentery, skin and bone, with dead eyes. I could only hear his voice. It was the sole indication that he was alive. Where did he get the strength to talk? "You mustn't rejoice too soon, my boy. There's selection here, too, more often than outside. Germany doesn't need sick Jews. Germany doesn't need me. When the next transport comes, you'll have a new neighbor. So listen to me and take my advice. Get out of the hospital before the next selection." These words, which came from under the ground, from a faceless shape, filled me with terror. It was indeed true that the hospital was very small and that if new invalids arrived in the next few days, room would have to be found for them. But perhaps my faceless neighbor, fearing that he would be among the first victims, simply wanted to drive me away to free my bed in order to give himself a chance to survive. Perhaps he just wanted to frighten me. Yet, what if he were telling the truth? I decided to await events. The doctor came to tell me that the operation would be the next day. "Don't be afraid," he added. "Everything will be all right." At 10 o'clock in the morning, they took me into the operating room. My doctor was there. I took comfort from this. I felt that nothing serious could happen while he was there. There was balm in every word he spoke, and every glance he gave me held a message of hope. It will hurt you a bit, he said, but that will pass. Grit your teeth. The operation lasted an hour. They had not put me to sleep. I kept my eyes fixed upon my doctor. Then I felt myself go under. When I came round, opening my eyes, I could see nothing at first but a great whiteness, my sheets. Then I noticed the face of my doctor bending over me. Everything went off well. You're brave, my boy. Now you're going to stay here for 2 weeks, rest comfortably, and it will be over. You'll eat well and relax your body and your nerves. I could only follow the movements of his lips. I scarcely understood what he was saying, but the murmur of his voice did me good. Suddenly, a cold sweat broke out on my forehead. I could not feel my leg. Had they amputated it? Doctor, I stammered. Doctor!
What's the matter, son?
I lacked the courage to ask him the question. Doctor, I'm thirsty. He had water brought to me. He was smiling. He was getting ready to go and visit the other patients. Doctor?
What?
Shall I still be able to use my leg? He was no longer smiling. I was very frightened. He said, Do you trust me, my boy? I trust you absolutely, doctor.
Well, then listen to me. You'll be completely recovered in a fortnight. You'll be able to walk like anyone else. The sole of your foot was all full of pus. We just had to open the swelling. You haven't had your leg amputated. You'll see. In a fortnight's time, you'll be walking about like everyone else.
I had only a fortnight to wait. 2 days after my operation, there was a rumor going round the camp that the front had suddenly drawn nearer. The Red Army, they said, was advancing on Buna. It was only a matter of hours now. We were already accustomed to rumors of this kind. It was not the first time a false prophet had foretold to us peace on earth, negotiations with the Red Cross for our release, or other false rumors. And often we believed them. It was an injection of morphine. But this time these prophecies seemed more solid. During these last few nights, we had heard the guns in the distance. My neighbor, the faceless one, said, Don't let yourself be fooled with illusions. Hitler has made it very clear that he will annihilate all the Jews before the clock strikes 12, before they can hear the last stroke. I burst out, What does it matter to you? Do we have to regard Hitler as a prophet? His glazed, faded eyes looked at me. At last he said in a weary voice, I've got more faith in Hitler than in anyone else. He's the only one who's kept his promises, all his promises, to the Jewish people. At 4 o'clock on the afternoon of the same day, as usual, the bell summoned all the heads of the blocks to go and report. They came back shattered. They could only just open their lips enough to say the word evacuation. The camp was to be emptied, and we were to be sent farther back. Where to? To somewhere right in the depths of Germany, to other camps. There was no shortage of them. When?
Tomorrow evening.
Perhaps the Russians will arrive first.
Perhaps.
We knew perfectly well that they would not. The camp had become a hive. People ran about, shouting at one another. In all the blocks, preparations for the journey were going on. I had forgotten about my bad foot. A doctor came into the room and announced, Tomorrow, immediately after nightfall, the camp will set out, block after block. Patients will stay in the infirmary. They will not be evacuated. This news made us think. Were the SS going to leave hundreds of prisoners to strut about in the hospital blocks, waiting for their liberators? Were they going to let the Jews hear the 12th stroke sound? Obviously not. All the invalids will be summarily killed, said the faceless one, and sent to the crematory in a final batch. The camp is certain to be mined, said another. The moment the evacuation's over, it'll blow up. As for me, I was not thinking about death, but I did not want to be separated from my father. We had already suffered so much, borne so much together. This was not the time to be separated.
I ran outside to look for him. The snow was thick, and the windows of the blocks were veiled with frost. One shoe in my hand, because it would not go onto my right foot, I ran on, feeling neither pain nor cold. "What shall we do?" My father did not answer. "What shall we do, father?" He was lost in thought. The choice was in our hands. For once we could decide our fate for ourselves. We could both stay in the hospital, where I could, thanks to my doctor, get him entered as a patient or a nurse. Or else we could follow the others. "Well, what shall we do, father?" He was silent. "Let's be evacuated with the others," I said to him. He did not answer. He looked at my foot.
"Do you think you can walk?"
"Yes, I think so."
"Let's hope that we shan't regret it, Eliezer."
I learned after the war the fate of those who had stayed behind in the hospital. They were quite simply liberated by the Russians 2 days after the evacuation. I did not go back to the hospital again. I returned to my block. My wound was open and bleeding. The snow had grown red where I had trodden. The head of the block gave out double rations of bread and margarine for the journey. We could take as many shirts and other clothes as we liked from the store. It was cold. We got into bed. The last night in Buna. Yet another last night. The last night at home. The last night in the ghetto. The last night in the train. And now the last night in Buna. How much longer were our lives to be dragged out from one last night to another? I did not sleep at all. Through the frosted panes, bursts of red light could be seen. Cannon shots split the nighttime silence. How close the Russians were. Between them and us, one night, our last night. There was whispering from one bed to another. With luck, the Russians would be here before the evacuation. Hope revived again. Someone shouted, "Try and sleep. Gather your strength for the journey." This reminded me of my mother's last words of advice in the ghetto. But I could not sleep. My foot felt as if it were burning. In the morning, the face of the camp had changed. Prisoners appeared in strange outfits. It was like a masquerade. Everyone had put on several garments, one on top of the other, in order to keep out the cold. Poor mountebanks, wider than they were tall, more dead than alive. Poor clowns, their ghost-like faces emerging from piles of prison clothes. Buffoons. I tried to find a shoe that was too large. In vain. I tore up a blanket and wrapped my wounded foot in it. Then I went wandering through the camp, looking for a little more bread and a few potatoes. Some said we were being taken to Czechoslovakia. No, to Gorozen. No, to Gliwice. No, to... 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the snow was still coming down thickly. The time was passing quickly now. Dusk had fallen. The day was disappearing in a monochrome of gray. The head of the block suddenly remembered that he had forgotten to clean out the block. He ordered 4 prisoners to wash the wooden floor. An hour before leaving the camp. Why? For whom? "For the liberating army," he cried, "so that they'll realize there were men living here and not pigs." Were we men, then? The block was cleaned from top to bottom, washed in every corner. At 6 o'clock, the bell rang, the death knell, the burial. The procession was about to begin its march. "Form up, quickly!" In a few moments, we were all in rows, by blocks. Night had fallen. Everything was in order, according to the prearranged plan. The searchlights came on. Hundreds of armed SS men rose up out of the darkness, accompanied by sheepdogs. The snow never ceased. The gates of the camp opened. It seemed that an even darker night was waiting for us on the other side. The first blocks began to march. We waited. We had to wait for the departure of the 56 blocks who came before us. It was very cold. In my pocket I had 2 pieces of bread. With how much pleasure could I have eaten them? But I was not allowed to, not yet. Our turn was coming, block 53. Block 55. Block 57, forward march. It snowed relentlessly. An icy wind blew in violent gusts, but we marched without faltering. The SS made us increase our pace. Faster, you swine, you filthy sons of bitches! Why not? The movement warmed us up a little. The blood flowed more easily in our veins. One felt oneself reviving. Faster, you filthy sons of bitches! We were no longer marching. We were running, like automatons. The SS were running too, their weapons in their hands. We looked as though we were fleeing before them. Pitch darkness, every now and then an explosion in the night. They had orders to fire on any who could not keep up. Their fingers on the triggers, they did not deprive themselves of this pleasure. If one of us stopped for a second, a sharp shot finished off another filthy son of a bitch. I was putting one foot in front of the other mechanically. I was dragging with me this skeletal body which weighed so much. If only I could have got rid of it. In spite of my efforts not to think about it, I could feel myself as two entities, my body and me. I hated it. I repeated to myself, "Don't think. Don't stop. Run." Near me, men were collapsing in the dirty snow. Shots. At my side marched a young Polish lad called Zalman. He had been working in the electrical warehouse at Buna. They had laughed at him because he was always praying or meditating on some problem of the Talmud. It was his way of escaping from reality, of not feeling the blows. He was suddenly seized with cramp in the stomach. "I've got stomach ache," he whispered to me. He could not go on. He had to stop for a moment. I begged him, "Wait a bit, Zalman. We shall all be stopping soon. We're not going to run like this till the end of the world." But as he ran, he began to undo his buttons, crying, "I can't go on any longer. My stomach's bursting." "Make an effort, Zalman. Try." "I can't," he groaned. His trousers lowered. He let himself sink down. That is the last picture I have of him. I do not think it can have been the SS who finished him, because no one had noticed. He must have been trampled to death beneath the feet of the thousands of men who followed us. I quickly forgot him. I began to think of myself again. Because of my painful foot, a shudder went through me at each step. "A few more yards," I thought. "A few more yards, and that will be the end. I shall fall." A spurt of red flame, a shot. Death wrapped itself around me till I was stifled. It stuck to me. I felt that I could touch it. The idea of dying, of no longer being, began to fascinate me. Not to exist any longer, not to feel the horrible pains in my foot, not to feel anything, neither weariness, nor cold, nor anything, to break the ranks, to let oneself slide to the edge of the road. My father's presence was the only thing that stopped me. He was running at my side, out of breath, at the end of his strength, at his wit's end. I had no right to let myself die. What would he do without me? I was his only support. These thoughts had taken up a brief space of time, during which I had gone on running without feeling my throbbing foot, without realizing that I was running, without being conscious that I owned a body galloping there on the road in the midst of so many thousands of others. When I came to myself again, I tried to slacken the pace, but there was no way. A great tidal wave of men came rolling onward and would have crushed me like an ant. I was simply walking in my sleep. I managed to close my eyes and to run like that while asleep. Now and then someone would push me violently from behind and I would wake up. The other would shout, "Run faster! If you don't want to go on, let other people come past." All I had to do was to close my eyes for a second, to see a whole world passing by, to dream a whole lifetime.
This ends side one of cassette 2. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.